Okay, this is Karen Brewster and Reed and Marlene McCluskey continuing on what did we say it was, January 7th, 2020. Just had a nice break. So, Reed, I wanted to ask you about the leaseback program. We kind of skipped over that, and I know that was a big part of what you worked on. So can you talk about that a little bit?
On arrival there at the park, I know there'd been some mention, Clay must have mentioned on the phone when I talked to him about the job, but I wasn't at all familiar with the historic leasing program. And so it didn't really sink in, I don't think, until I arrived. And when someone on the staff there said, oh, that file cabinet in your office, that's all the leasing stuff. And it was a two-drawer file cabinet, and it was just packed with individual file folders on all these leases. Well, you know, I began to research that, study the legal underpinnings, and see, read the leases themselves. There were summary documents that Bruce Reed had done up, and it became apparent to me that Bruce, with his military background especially, as apparently was very fond of having standardized correspondence set up for certain recurring events involving the leases. And so on in digital records, I started to find a lot of those records as well, but most of it was actually hard copy printed out. And as I began to get out on the street and visit some of those locations and meet some of the current lessees, and introduce myself and then talk more about, you know, what they were doing, how they were doing it. And so, I mean, it became more and more apparent that, okay, the expectation here is that there will be continued income stream for the park to use for the purposes of maintaining these buildings and anything related to that. And by that time, I think the income stream was supporting things like regular fire sprinkler testing that's done annually, not just on the lease buildings, but on all the park buildings that were in the historic district. That was a big deal. But were all of the tenants meeting the limitations of restrictions placed on them? In some cases, yes. Some cases, no. You know, I try and approach some of those things carefully and not upset anybody's apple cart. What I would routinely tell both the staff, our staff, and tenants at various times is that I recognized, and everybody on the staff should recognize and act like they recognize, that while it's not our responsibility to make sure that the tenants are a success, that they're financially, you know, well off, it's certainly incumbent on us to make sure that we don't do anything to, you know, mess them up. It's like, we don't want to stand in their way. We want them to be a success, because that's the only way they're going to be able to pay their rent. That's the only way they're actually going to be able to help preserve the building and occupy it the way we want. But there were pretty strict limitations on what they were supposed to be able to do. And routinely, I would get requests, field requests from various tenants to make changes. They want to make changes in what they were selling, but more often it was how they were actually displaying goods for sale. I want to put racks here. I want to, can I take this wall out? No, you can't take that wall out. You know, it's like, can I put in new lighting here? Or, you know, I want to put in track lighting, or I want to, you know, display these in the windows or things like that. In some cases, it would be things like, I want to bring in a new safe. Can I bring in, you know, because I've got all this jewelry I want to put in. And that safe is going to overload the floor here, you know, and they wouldn't have known that. They don't, and it's like they would just, I think, push the limits, mm-hmm. Many of them. But I always felt like, gee, this is the best thing that we have going here. There were 9 leases at the time, and that was probably the most we ever had. Or 9 leases at one time. It was probably, I want to say, maybe a total of 10,000 square feet under lease, which isn't all that much, except that on average at that point, it was probably about $4 a square foot. So you're looking at about $40,000, or no, I'm sorry, it was more than that, 10,000 square feet. We were bringing, even then, it was more like $250,000 a year in total lease revenues, and it went up from there. Mm-hmm. And that was money that stayed in the park budget. Never went to Washington, never went to Anchorage. It wasn't somebody else's to dole out to us later. These were in park accounts. And so it could be used in ways that appropriated funds were never available to us to use.
Now, you said you used it to put back into maintaining the buildings.
The sideboards were placed on us by the legal authority and the National Historic Preservation Act amendments. I'm going to say in 1983, but I'm not sure of the date. But in any case, the sideboards said, yes, you can, you agency, if you declare a structure to be surplus to government needs, but it's an historic structure and you want to preserve that structure, you keep the structure, you keep the property, you can lease it out under certain conditions. Most of the time it has to be a competitive opportunity. And then you can use that money to preserve historic properties within that district. Now, that meant that those sideboards were wide enough to allow the park at times to extend assistance in some fashion to private property owners within the historic district. And that's where Grant Crosby at times was in town or brought into town in order to act as nothing more than a consultant to a private property owner. I don't think the property owners were aware of that, how that was working. They just knew that, gee, can we have, you know, this historical architect come visit? Oh, yeah, we can do that. I don't think we went so far as to pay for improvements to someone else's property, but, it got them things times.
Mm-hmm. Could you use the money for buying other properties or for...
Couldn't use it for buying property. What we could do is we could hire painters to paint buildings, or we could hire someone to work, like Roy Nelson, if he worked on plumbing, mm-hmm. If he was working on the restoration crew or something like that. I mean, you could use money for someone like that. We bought scaffolding, we bought paint. Mm-hmm. We bought, it's like you could send people to training.
Or you said the sprinkler systems and things like that.
Sprinkler systems, again, contributes to the preservation of the building. Anything like that.
Okay.
And so the sideboards are fairly wide, but it was used within the park. And I think we might have got as high as, I want to say $325,000 on an annual basis, because obviously what was happening was that rents were escalating, and that became an issue as well. We had 2 buildings that were under 15-year leases, long-term leases. And in those cases, hadn't really built in escalators. And so Jeff Brady was among those that for 15 years, the rent that was set, the outset, was more or less the rent that he paid
right.
at the end of his 15-year lease, by which time the cruise industry had taken off. All of the surrounding properties, were much more expensive, probably doubled or tripled what he was paying on a square foot basis for that property. And he was worried about that, I think, as rightfully so. I think Casey McBride, who had the place next to him, mm-hmm. Was in the same circumstance. And we all kind of held our breath. One of my jobs was to order the appraisals that were needed in order to set the stage for the request for proposals, the RFPs, So I would write up the RFPs, place the advertisements in various newspapers, and then receive the proposals. I would normally, actually well before that, would draft the leases. I would start with the last lease, anything that was the most recent edition of a lease, start with that, and then customize it to a particular building. So it was particular to the address and the square footage and the permissible uses and so on. And then working closely with a realty, or rather a concession specialist, Jill Morgan normally, or Kevin Apgar in the regional office, working closely with them to review the draft lease. We would normally bounce it back and forth between the two of us until we were satisfied. Then it had to go to the our solicitor. So DOI solicitor would be the final review. Normally it would be three of us in a conference call, seldom actually physically together in the same place. We'd settle on a final lease, and that's what would be advertised in the RFP.
And so that's advertising for businesses who might want to come in and lease that building.
Exactly. And the appraisal established the minimum acceptable rent. And so there was very little or no latitude to do anything other than tell people, you got to be willing to pay at least this much. You can offer more if you want. if you think it'll win out the competition, you can offer more.
Did anybody ever offer more?
Yes.
Oh.
And in fact, at one point, we had someone offer, I don't know, half again or even more than what the base was. The problem was that when you looked at his financials, couldn't figure out where that money was going to come from. It was like, what? There's nothing in here about financing your startup costs. And
did they think they were going to make so much money by selling their products?
Well, there's that. But I think in this one particular case, I thought, I think there's someone else involved in this who's a silent partner, and they're not saying anything about him, and they're certainly not pointing out where that money. And so when we said, gee, it doesn't look like there's any financing to this. Are you sure? It is like, so it was like, okay, that one gets us aside. Let me go on. And I really emphasize to individuals that express an interest in leasing and say, if you come into my office now, you can ask me any questions you want. That what goes out in the public advertisement, I really can't add to that. I can clarify if you don't understand some things in here. And to be very careful about that. But tell them, we're not only interested in money. The evaluation criteria, and they're laid out in the RFP, here's like half a dozen criteria. And one of those is going to be compatibility with the historic scene, compatibility with the preservation goals for this building, for the Park Service. Those are really important to us. Almost more important than the money. It's like so. And so you need to understand that this is going to be important, what you propose to do here. You know, and I would say, if you propose to set up a blacksmith shop in one of these places with a hearth, and you're going to like forge horseshoes or whatever you're going to do here, okay, not a winner.
It's like, in old wooden buildings, yes.
Yeah, an old wooden building. No, it's not going to, yeah. I said, that's an extreme example, but I'd give you an idea. And the same is true if you want to propose to do a cafe or, you know, a hot dog stand, whatever. If you're going to be needing to store food, heat food, dispose of food, it's like, you know what? None of those are really going to fly either. And that's stated outright in
right.
The, you know, so... But so printing stacks of the RFPs, I would send out to have all the printing done, receive those, and then initially those are all mailed, and of course today it's all electronic.
Right. Now, who set the rent?
The minimum acceptable lease rate was established by independent contract appraisal. So I would deal directly with the realty office in Anchorage, in the regional office in Anchorage, I would just submit a request for an appraisal for a particular property, give them all the details, mm-hmm. and they would then arrange the contract with a private appraiser. It varies. I don't know that it was maybe once or twice anyone other than Horan and Company, or originally it was Horan and Karak, out of Sitka. And nobody else seemed to want to travel to Skagway. and I learned later, oh, well, that's because Horan was also the city of Skagway assessor.
Oh.
So they had the contract to do the assessor's work for the city, and so they were willing to piggyback.
Right.
And of course, it helped them from the standpoint that they were always looking for rental information, you know, lease information, and we were paying them to
right.
go
well,
out.
Well, they already they sort of knew the local market. I mean,
they knew the local market, and they kind of knew who to tap, who would talk to them about, who would be a landlord that would mm-hmm. divulge their rents.
So were Park Service rents comparable to private renting?
That was the requirement. That was the appraiser. What they were doing was trying to determine the most comparable properties for which they could determine rents and with confidence. Their concern, obviously, was often, gee, you can't use less than arm's length transactions. If it's a landlord renting to a friend, they have to discount those. The issue that I had was that I felt that the appraisers were doing us a disservice by reducing, in some cases eliminating altogether, potential proposers, potential renters, by virtue of comparing us directly to every private property out there without adjustment. My suggestion to them was, if I'm a jeweler and I talk to a landlord and this landlord tells me I can change anything I want in here, lighting, I can put in drop ceilings, I can put in new flooring, and I can put in mirrors and, you know, I mean, and jewelry cases galore and safes in the back, and that's considered comparable to a park property where there's limited floor loading. No, you can't change the lighting. No, you can't knock out walls. We're not going to let you do all of these things that you want to do. That's not comparable. There should be an adjustment. I said, and our purposes are best served by having the greatest variety of proposals
right.
from which to choose, because we have these other selection criteria that we want to apply. And so if you set the minimum, normally an appraisal is trying to establish the best market rate possible for somebody to rent something or sell something, because you can never raise the price, but
right.
you can always lower it, right? Well, we can't lower it. You're setting the floor.
Right.
And we
the minimum.
We can't even negotiate anything less
right.
than that. So if I said, I know this is not an exact science, and you really should be working in this range, and if there's a range, you should be here.
Not middle.
It's like, no, at the bottom.
Oh, at the bottom.
If this is your range, this is what we want to know, is this
right.
one here.
But remember, one of the renters, Sue Rapley, mm-hmm. said that the rent that the Park Service had set at was too high. She couldn't make a profit, and she actually offered less. To make the point.
Yeah.
Right.
And of course, I had to do exactly what I told her I would have to do before she even submitted it. She said, well, can I submit a proposal and offer less than the minimum? And I said, you can. Nothing to prevent you from doing that. However, we can't consider it. I can't even, legally, I can't consider it. We just have to return it to you saying, thanks, you don't meet the minimum in our requirements, even if there are no other bidders.
Mm-hmm.
We just have to, if there are no other bidders, and that happened to us a couple of times, there are no other bidders, then we have to go back to the appraiser, pay them another $5,000, and say, try again.
Can you come up with a lower minimum?
Well, we've just established by opening it to the market that the figure you came up with isn't the right figure.
Right.
It's not valid. And so now, and of course, they save face by saying, well, if I do another appraisal, it will be at a different time. And because it's a different time, see, it's not exactly the same. So if it comes out at a different level, well, that's because circumstances have changed.
And so did you have to do that?
We did.
You did? And
more than once.
And did they come back with a lower...
Sure. Well, they can't do anything other than that. They have to...
And then you were able to lease it?
And then we would turn around and we'd open it up again. And in one instance, we received one proposal. And that was for the combined advertising of Pantheon Red Front and Red Front together. Very first time, it was not finished in the interior. It was just down the stud walls. We stopped our rehab or construction at that point, and said the new proposer can finish the interior, finish wiring, finish the, okay. So we get one proposal, and the proposal was from Alaska Fur Gallery. And their proposal was so poorly crafted and so sketchy on the finances and other factors that Jill Morgan and I both recommended that we reject this as not acceptable and move on. And basically, we're going to have to go and get another appraisal. We're going to have to go back out. And her supervisor, chief of concessions for the region, Kevin Apgar, overrode us with the approval of the superintendent at the time, and we ended up with Alaska Fur Gallery for the next 10 years and fought what amounted to a non-stop battle to get compliance and to get rents. 10 years.
Were all the leases written for such long terms?
Almost any business operator will tell you it's location, location, location. You've heard that.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're going to set up in a particular location, they don't want to think that they can only be there for a year or two or three. They want to know they're going to be there for a period of time. And so effectively, the shortest lease we ever issued was for 5 years. And I think we did that a couple of times. And even then, it was dicey business for the tenant. In one case, they were happy it was only 5 years because it really wasn't a winning deal for them. And they did not attempt to renew. There is no such thing as a renewal. And that's another thing I would have to tell them. There's no such thing as a renewal. What there is an opportunity to compete again for another lease if they so desired. So if a tenant had been there for, like Jeff Brady had, for 15 years and said in year 15 that, gee, I'd really like this to continue, then they had to put together a proposal, give us our best shot, and hope that their proposal carried the day, that they would win the evaluation, the competitive review. And normally the evaluations are done by a panel of three individuals. Normally I would be one. So I would be the park representative, and then we'd have two others normally from outside the park. Typically one person from the concessions office, it would be Jill, usually, and then we'd have one other, normally concession specialist from another park or someone along those lines. So you'd have three people that would then evaluate those, give each a score, and then make a recommendation to the superintendent and the regional chief of concessions, and they'd make a selection.
So how did you evaluate? How did you decide for the ones that you put forward?
The selection criteria were stated in the RFP. And so some of those I've already shared with you. One of them is, how much rent would you like to pay? Yeah. You know, so that was a factor. And you just assign a score to various levels there. Among the factors were the experience, the burden of experience that an individual might have in the enterprise that they're proposing to undertake. Do they have any creds?
Yeah.
They know what they're doing? You know, I mean, are you speaking from experience or this is just kind of a wild guess? This would be great.
Right.
You know, we had somebody propose one time they were going to sell aromatherapy pillows from one of the locations. They're going to be great. And their only experience was in operating a small, like a candle shop in New Orleans or someplace like that. It was like, okay, thank you for that. Yeah, that one didn't succeed. We had some that threw money, but the rest of the proposal was really poor. We had some that ignored the limitations on the use of the space. Some that I think we usually included the period of operation. We really wanted to encourage someone to operate on a year-round basis. Mm-hmm. I mean, that would have been ideal for town. You know, we have something that isn't otherwise available in town. Everything else shuts up. Well, there was usually a token effort to say, gee, we'll stay open until the middle of October, you know, which is past the end of the cruise season, or a couple of times they'd say, gee, we'll be open limited hours until after Christmas. And one of the tenants is still doing just that, as far as I know. Very limited, intermittent, but their merchandise, is the kind of thing that people might want to pick up. You know, they carry toys for kids and things like that, that there might be a market for locally. And they'll arrange to open on weekends, you know, before Christmas, up until Christmas, things like that. But generally, you realize that the market's being driven entirely by cruise ship traffic. So,
now, were there some businesses that, like, let's say they had that 10-year lease, but they didn't last 10 years? I mean, the 10 years is a long time for a business that's very much tourist-oriented.
I don't think it was anybody that folded before the end of their lease.
Okay.
However, I made reference to the one party that was glad that theirs was only 5 years.
Right.
We actually negotiated our way to an arrangement that allowed them to finish out their lease on the first floor. It was two floors, so upstairs and down, and they discovered pretty quickly that there were no customers going to go upstairs. This is what's going to happen. And even they're using the second floor space as quarters or as backstock storage, or, you know, that there were limitations there. We wouldn't let them use it as quarters unless they put in, I think they had to put in a restroom, a small kitchenette kind of arrangement. Well, that would have meant wiring and plumbing changes. It would have cost quite a bit. We weren't going to be able to do that. And so they just didn't have the need for it. And recognizing that, that was about the time we were suffering growing pains in the park and needing more office space. And again, the prerequisite for any of these leases is that the space be declared as surplus to government needs. Well, if you've got growing pains and you don't have room for staff, it kind of undermines that argument that these are surplus. We're just leasing them because we want the money. So in this case, knowing that resources folks were champing at the bit for more space. This was after Teresa had taken over the division, and they were adding more staff. I think we ended up with Elaine up there. Might have. In any case, what I did was to approach the tenants and say, would you be agreeable to an arrangement whereby we basically take back the second floor and make a corresponding adjustment in the lease rate based upon the values assigned in the appraisal? And they were very happy to hear that. Mm-hmm. It was like, oh yeah, that would be really good. So our rent would go down. I said, yes. And we can split the utilities. You know, we'll just take the, you know, electric rate, you know, it was 1 meter for the, mm-hmm. and we'll divide that in two. And they were very happy so that was one that I think saved a tenant.
So why did that one be, why was that one 5 years where 10 or 15 is more standard?
Their proposal was for 5 years because they weren't really certain. They weren't as confident. I think I'm really kind of surprised that Jeff and Casey been 15 years right up front. Mm-hmm. Changes in the regulations, the implementing regulations for the leasing program at one point made it explicit that the leases needed to be as short a period of time as would be practical for the intended use. And so you really were going to have to justify something more than 10 years. I mean, we were able to argue successfully that, you know, letting people propose anything from 5 to 10 years in duration, we wouldn't have to jump through these hoops more often than we really wanted to mm-hmm. have to do that. These renewals came in waves, in part because of the way that they were advertised initially. And so those first few years for me, it was a lot of work because there were leases that were coming up, and then Redfront and Pantheon were being completed. We wanted to lease those. Mm-hmm. And we did have issues with other properties, like in the alley, Miss Kitty's, what was leased to Sue Rapley mm-hmm. as Miss Kitty's Buttonhole in the alley. I would tell people, I said, Sue has done everything to make that place a success, except stand out in the alley naked to draw folks back into the shop here. She would do anything. You know, she parked a Model A out there, JJ had, and mannequins were put up, you know, the feather boas and, you know, yeah, it was everything she just wasn't making enough. When it got to the point where I couldn't do anything more than I had done, wasn't really permissible for me to tell an appraiser how to do their job. I went as far as I thought I could in suggesting where the public's best interests lay and making the case for them. This is mm-hmm. how you articulate why this makes sense. This is what we, and they would dutifully listen, nod, smile, and say, okay, well, we'll be back in touch. And it would be the same as always. It would be, here's what's comparable. More and more, this was very disappointing for me, through time, they found fewer comparables in other businesses, and they were using Park Service buildings with earlier leases as comparables.
That doesn't seem right.
Isn't that the snake swallowing its own tail?
Yeah, it doesn't seem right.
No, it doesn't seem right. And here I am being told, well, they have professional standards they have to meet. They can't listen to what you're telling them to. And then they're feeding us our own leases. It's like, okay, I'm having a problem with this. The way the government contracts for appraisals is that it's done by the lands office. And once the draft appraisal is submitted in fulfillment of the contract, it wouldn't come to the park, it would go to a review appraiser, a government review appraiser, who would review it to see that it met industry standards, professional standards, before they would give it the go ahead. Once that was on, then it would be transmitted to the park, and I would finally receive the appraisal and say, okay. Occasionally, I would have a request for someone, very rarely, someone might ask to see an appraisal. We were pretty tight-fisted with the appraisals because mm-hmm. it had a lot of information provided by other landlords and other properties. I was kind of like, well, I wouldn't just outright say no, but I'd say, you know, what is this about? And you know, it's kind of, similarly, I would occasionally get requests from people who want to know, how much are these rents? How much are people paying for them? Who are the tenants? Who are the lessees? And how much are they paying? Occasionally, I get a request from Demetra.
Lavrakis,
working for the Skagway News, as a reporter for the Skagway News. And she would say, gee, can I get a copy of your sheet that shows, you know, all of the tenant information and the lease rates and, you know, expiration dates and all that? And I would say, well, this is not something that the tenants want me to advertise. They don't want the government to advertise, want to trumpet how much they're paying in rent. I said, I'll tell you. I said, I'd be happy to tell you because it's public information. It's not, you know, I'm saying, but I would stop short of photocopying the whole thing and handing it off, knowing that's what would appear in an article in the paper. And that's a local paper, sits out in the supermarket and the, you know, it's like all over town. Right. And tenants had actually told me, if people think I'm paying, if my potential customers think I'm paying a lot in rent, they're going to think that my prices are inflated on account of it. And so don't go, the last thing in the world they wanted were park interpreters standing out on the street in front of their business, trumpeting how much rent we were collecting from a particular place. So I had to caution the seasonal interpreters against doing just that. I said, it's a great idea to tell people that, you know what, this is a great partnership arrangement, and it is helping to preserve these buildings without having to spend government-appropriated funds to do it. It's like, isn't that a great thing?
Right, it's a program that pays for itself.
It helps to pay for itself. It's never going to be, but it's like, this is a great deal because the city, city collects property tax from the tenant.
Oh, from the tenant.
The city collects sales tax from the tenant on the lease, on what they pay for the lease, and they collect sales tax from the tenant on the sale of their own goods out of the store. So the city's collecting three ways on that property right there. And here's the kicker. There's something called payments in lieu of taxes, PILT monies, okay? P-I-L-T. Okay, administered by the U.S. Forest Service, typically based upon how much federal lands are within a particular tax jurisdiction. You recognize if you got all these federal lands, it's drying up money for the local tax. So there's payment in lieu of taxes. So these are all government-owned properties. Guess what? They contribute to the PILT monies. So that's federal money.
So the PILT monies go to the city?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was wondering how you respond to an often stated comment about, well, this is, you know, the federal government competing with local business.
In this case, the buildings themselves, the people of these good United States have, and this is where I was kind of trying to pull the punch, but the people of these good United States have paid on average about $1 million apiece to restore or rehabilitate each of these historic buildings. I've said some higher, some lower, but let's say it's an average of $1 million apiece to bring them from a wreck, which is where they were, to where they are now. That was the ultimate in urban renewal for Skagway. Skagway was on the cusp of seeing a few more cruise passengers in the 60s, 70s, but still pretty, you know, there's a lot of gray wood buildings around.
Right.
People didn't want to risk their money on these old buildings. And I said, the infusion of millions in capital is what put this commercial district back on its feet. It put the railroad back in operation, in my view.
Right.
The railroad cast off the headquarters you know, the depot,
right,
and the headquarters building as white elephants. They were about to knock them down. They were going to destroy them, get rid of them, because they were just a big liability. It was a money pit, and they're right. They were right. It was definitely a money pit. But once those buildings were done and others started to come to life, other private building owners said, wow, this is working. There's more foot traffic here. And they could turn around on the strength of the government investment and go in and get their own loans and get their buildings started to be put back together. And so I'm sure people like Jan Rentmore,
the Red Onion.
Red Onion. Tim and
David Present.
Oh, David Present.
Which is another thing, because you were talking about how the appraisers were setting their price for the park buildings based on the market. But what was happening was it was going the other way too. So it was a circle. So David mm-hmm. Present was then setting his rates, what the park service were, and they were all artificially high. So at least one renter that we know of told him, well, I'm going to go see what the rent is over here at the park service in order to get him to come down on his rent. And they're playing off
mm-hmm. Yeah, she came renters. In to see me. It was a classic. You know, oh yeah, yeah, I'm going to put in a proposal. And she made all the outward signs, whatever, and you realize, oh, we never saw a proposal from you. Well, no, she was able to negotiate a much better rent.
From somebody else.
Yeah. I thought, okay.
Yeah.
But it works. Yeah.
You know, it certainly was a complaint in the beginning that they thought for private business was going to be somehow affected by the Park Service leasing their buildings.
If someone had, let's say, was running a grocery and thought there was going to be competing grocery, you know, right next door, you could totally see that. And to some degree, that argument will always hold water, because somebody's going to be in one of our buildings that's selling tchotchkes. They look an awful lot like the tchotchkes next door. And that's why these aren't concessions. Mm-hmm. People will ask occasionally, well, how come these aren't concessions? You know, well, concessions law takes up a whole bookshelf.
Yeah.
Okay? It's enormous. The laws governing concessions in national parks, mammoth by comparison.
Yeah.
Really difficult to administer, very expensive to administer, and what's more, instead of just rents, Park Service takes rents plus 12% of your gross.
Right.
It's like, thank you very much. You know, it's like things right. like that.
And in the leaseback program, you don't take anything from their profits.
I don't know anything about their profits. I don't know. Yeah, we don't get a cut of anything mm-hmm. they make or don't make. It's entirely on them to pay their expenses. Now, what they're paying for is insurance on the property, naming the government as additional insured. Okay, so that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
They're paying for interior upkeep, maintenance. They got to keep it clean. They got to keep everything in operating condition. We pay for the operation or the maintenance of the heating plant and the sprinkler system, because those will burn the building down
right.
or not. right. but if they have a plumbing leak, that's their responsibility inside the building as the tenant. Outside the building, the shell of the building, the outside, that's on us. And we use their rent money to maintain that. We give it a pressure wash at the beginning of the season, you know, and so on. So we maintain the outside, but they're paying utilities, they're paying insurance, they're paying maintenance, and they're paying the property tax, and they're paying sales tax. And not just the sales tax on their sales tax on the rents.
Mm-hmm.
And so the city's not losing a dime, and in fact, they're making more than they would on another private property because of the PILT monies. There's pretty strict sideboards on how they can display wares
right.
That are always difficult for the tenants to accept. What do you mean I can't put neon lights in here or whatever? What do you mean I can't, you know, put, I mean, and it's the jewelers, I think, that have the biggest heartburn because they want to see everything sparkle. And they say, no, you can't use 5,000 Kelvin. Yeah.
I also have heard express the feeling that it seems like all of Skagway is jewelry stores, not that all the Park Service building, mm-hmm. but in general, that there's too many jewelry stores.
I could never openly express a bias against jewelry stores. It would have been unfair to anybody that was in the jewelry business.
So you took whatever proposals you got, whether...
We did, and had to. And right. So there was nothing inherently wrong. However, having said that, what I would point out is that they can't... We got to the point we wouldn't let them change any of the interior lighting. If you want dazzling lighting inside your case, displaying, then it has to be case in-case lighting or something that is part of the casework. It can't be hardwired built into the building because that just means more holes and walls, more wiring runs, more changes, you know. And so it's not good for the long-term preservation of the building, and it certainly doesn't contribute to the historic scene. If you want to bring in a 3-ton safe, it's probably not going to work.
So those restrictions kind of help limit that maybe a jewelry store wouldn't put in a proposal?
Yes. And quite frankly, to be perfectly honest, that was part of my objective, was to say, I hear the complaint from everybody that there's too many jewelry stores. Who needs another jewelry store here? Do we really want kind of a cheesy-looking jewelry store in here? Or would we like something more like Jeff Brady's bookstore? I would openly point to potential bidders, and I would say, or visitors, I would say, this epitomizes, you know, what we like to see. I mean, look, mm-hmm. The decor is consistent with the period. Yeah, he's got electronic equipment in there. I know that. You know, I'm not going to get too overboard on this, but. A lot of his titles are interpretive materials. Mm-hmm. You know, they're historic, either novels or picture books, history pieces, great stuff, okay? And he's got the office upstairs with a newspaper he's publishing out of the offices upstairs. This is great. You know, the copier services in the back room, everybody in town needs. That's very useful to everybody. This provides a lot of services mm-hmm. that people really rely upon. Not every business is a bookstore.
Right.
The primary complaint that Marlene pointed out earlier that was leveled against Alaska Natural History Association sales areas inside the park buildings was that we were unfairly competing with them because they were selling books too. I didn't want to see crossover in the titles because it would hurt their sales. And that complaint was coming from Jeff Brady via Steve Heitz to the superintendent and had the desired effect. It was in the run-up to the end of Jeff's lease that he became most concerned about that. And I understand, I get that, but, you know, how many people go into every shop? That's what I would submit mm-hmm. to you, is that people pick and choose. They go into this one or that one. I went into the visitor center. I didn't go into the bookstore. You're not going to, not everyone goes everywhere. Right. Not everybody sees every nook and cranny. And so, yeah. Are there t-shirts all over? Yes. Mm-hmm. Thankfully, I don't think we're selling too many t-shirts although I don't know anything. In the Alaska Geo store across the street now. That used to be the Trail Center, of course, across the street, the little blue building.
And it used to be Martin Itchen's house at some point.
Yes, although it lived somewhere else.
Yeah.
How many buildings were taken out of the leasing program?
So what was the Itchen house? is now Alaska Geo, but they're, I'm sure, still not paying rent.
But is that...
I shouldn't say that. I suspect they're not paying rent.
But know. That's a Park Service building?
It's a Park Service building.
Could have been rented, but never was.
Right. And the mascot would be one that hasn't been leased.
It was never leased. That one was always an exhibit, and then storage upstairs, and the lab in the back. So the ones that she's asking about are the ones that at one point were under lease, and the Park Service in the years after we arrived, and in some cases since I've retired, mm-hmm. That have been removed from the leasing program. They're no longer being listed. Right. Would be Itchen, probably. You'd have to ask about Alaska Geo's occupancy. And then Pantheon Saloon, which is where now the Park Service has the Ginger Ranger Activity Center.
For very limited hours, I noticed this last
always,
summer.
Yeah. It's a staffing thing.
Right, and then upstairs is the curatorial
stuff.
Upstairs of Red Front is the curatorial, and actually the back of the, So that's never been under lease.
Right.
So the first floor space there. Boss Bakery building, which is now the Trail Center, Chilkoot Trail Center. And the Verbal Wheaties.
Miss Kitty's was.
Verbal Wheaties Cribs building in the alley behind Verbal Wheaties store. Is where Miss Kitty's was, where Sue had her place.
I talked to the descendant of Verbal Wheaties. He lives in, what's that little country? Luxembourg, I think.
Hmm.
And he has a casino. They did very well from the money that Verbal Wheaties made there in Skagway, running whores.
Oh, is that what Verbal Wheaties did?
Yeah, and it took a lot of digging before I found that out. And actually, I was talking to him in French, and so Buckwheat got very jealous and told me I couldn't talk to him anymore because I was speaking French. So he didn't understand.
No.
Right.
But it was kind of fun to...
Not uncommon to have had a cigar store, candy... smokes or whatever up front, and then in the back was, the other stuff.
Yeah.
In this case, had been a connected building, I think, at one time.
Right.
So that was the Cribs in the alley. So that's now the Ranger, the Protection Ranger's office is in that building where the Cribs, where Sue used to have her store.
Hmm. So that's the third one, if you don't count Itchen House. Which they had the... Parks Canada, and there, but Parks Canada never really paid rent.
The issue with our relationship with Parks Canada, and that's a whole other kind of subject. I don't if as far as leasing goes, it was almost an everyday affair for me to spend some amount of time in some aspect of the leasing. At one point, I actually even got an offer of bribery in my office one winter. We were advertising. It might have been Red Front, and it must have been like December or January that a guy showed up in my office, heavy like Brooklyn accent, and he. He wanted to talk about the leases and, I'm in this place here and he wanted to know all the details and, I talked him through my usual spiel. I'm sitting at my desk in uniform and and then he wanted to know, I got to a certain point, it's like, how much is the key money?
The what? The key money?
The key money. And I had the same reaction. He's like, I'm not sure what you... I mean, we supply the keys for the, the building here. I'm thinking, I don't know what that means. And he said, the key money, so I could occupy right away. So I could just occupy. I could just, And I said, well, that's not actually the way it works. I've been explaining that, you know, here's the request for proposals, and you have to, and he's like, well, no, I need to know what the key money, well, how much do, you know, to just move in? It's like, oh, the key money. Like, I said, well, welcome to Alaska, and welcome to the National Park Service. You know, no, that's not the way it works here. If I really wanted to be a pisser about it, I suppose I would have just said, did you just offer me a bribe?
Well, if you'd been a different person, you could have said, oh, yeah, here, and then you pocket that, and then you give him. That would be what a corrupt person would have done.
Well, that,
yeah, but there's no way to get around the three-person committee.
They would have known that the language to use to, yeah, whatever, to finesse right. your way to a, yeah, here you go, there's the key.
Right.
That's what he was asking for.
Wow.
And I thought, wow, okay. That only happened once.
Did you enjoy doing this leaseback work?
Yes, I did. I hate to say it made me the big man on campus, but sometimes that's the way it felt, because people would be ushered into my office who were hat in hand, you know, wanting to know what's, how does this work? You know, one of the managers in the jewelry store that we had eventually as a tenant, and for 10 years as a tenant, came to know him fairly well, always called me Mr. Reed. He's an Indian man, and got to know him, on a more than cursory basis in some ways, but never a, gee, come and visit me at home kind of thing. You know, mm-hmm. He'd tell me about things were going in his personal life and vice versa. But I also knew that he taught me more about how that jewelry business works and what and how it worked for them. Than anybody else. I would watch him sometimes. I usually made a practice of at least once a week, sometimes more often, stopping into each of those and talking to the manager, coming in and in the process of talking to them, doing a quick mm-hmm. just look-see inspection, walk around, sometimes upstairs, and just so that they knew that this was not an unusual thing.
Right.
I would come by, look around, talk to them, oh, these extension cords, you really can't be here. This is kind of, you know, this is something you need to deal with. And in talking to them, you know, you get to know them better and better. I would call the Klupars probably something more like friends now, mm-hmm. Even though they made me tear my hair out sometimes. That's good. Very creative people, always trying to do something. Or get away. It felt like to me they were always trying to get away with a little extra. You want to say, no, can't do that. So yes, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the complexities of it. I enjoyed dealing with the legal end of it, writing contracts, and reviewing those with the government attorney, and then the satisfaction of seeing that process through to an award. In the case of Greg and Billy Clem, who are still tenants of one of the Park Service leases there, I was so happy for them that their proposal actually beat out the few others that were, you know, in competition. It was a very difficult space to occupy. It was not a really attractive space for hot competitors. But they are local folks, and they want to sell tours, they want to sell trinkets, they want to sell toys for kids, they want to, you know, it's like, I mean, and they're the ones that remain mm-hmm. and do limited hours on through into the Christmas season. And I've always thought, well, that's probably the closest thing we came to, you know. Let's see, when Casey did not finish out his lease, his second lease. He had a 15-year lease, and then he signed another 10, and then at some point decided he was going to retire and negotiated an assignment of his lease, a reassignment to Kathy and...
Chris Wassman.
Long, yeah. Kathy and Chris Wassman, and they do ivory jewelry and carvings, various mm-hmm. kinds, and they've got a great shop. I mean, it's really interesting. People dig it. It's very popular, but it's ideal for them because it's in the smallest square foot space on first floor that we have under lease.
Yeah.
You know, so it's the most efficient for them.
Right. Yeah. You had briefly mentioned the Historic District Commission, and I'm just wondering how much interaction you had with them, because they're the ones who set those standards about how the signs look and the colors of the building and all that.
The tenants had to come to us with their sign proposals and receive NPS approval before they submitted to the Historic District Commission. So HDC was secondary review in our book. It was like, we don't want you sending things to HDC without it being approved by Park Service first, because we always felt our review was going to be a little more strict in terms of signs. But because Carl was our representative initially on the HDC, expectation was that they were going to be pretty close. And so I would have to say that generally I was called to an HDC meeting to be present to speak on behalf of the landlord, mm-hmm. in the role of the landlord. That's really about the only time. So that was my role, was to stand up and say, why, yes, the landlord has approved the submission that's made to you now. And so it's for you, you know, for
them
to
review. So it was mostly between the tenant and HDC about what happened.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And my role was merely to say, to affirm that we've reviewed it and it's okay with us.
And the HDC covers all buildings in the Historic District, not just Park Service ones.
Correct.
It includes private,
yes,
owned businesses.
And even their guidelines, their rules evolved through time as well, as you'd expect. You know, it depends on the makeup of the HDC. But, you know, I never had, I didn't really have a regular cause to go before HDC.
Okay. So anything else about the leaseback program before we move to the next topic?
One thing I would add is that Parks Canada, those matches all taken off.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
There was talk when I first arrived. I think Clay Alderson had thought maybe that leasing to Parks Canada, leasing Itchen House to Parks Canada for the Trail Center operations was the way we might go. But I think what we hit on instead of that was something more like an MOU, with them paying their way in terms of utilities and some kind of a token payment to the Park Service. So we negotiated a way to something that filled that need.
Mm-hmm. So Parks Canada, you were a couple times you've mentioned talking about the relationship with mm-hmm. Parks Canada on the larger scale. You want to talk about that?
Their organization was somewhat different than ours. It was not directly analogous, position for position or park for park, because the office in Whitehorse had jurisdiction over all of the units within the Yukon and BC and northern BC, so the Chilkoot. Whereas our office was just Klondike. But in 1998, that was the year that the centennial proclamations declaring the establishment of Klondike Gold Rush International Historical Park were signed by Bill Clinton and Prime Minister Jean Chrétien. So there were parallel, but not necessarily duplicate, but parallel proclamations issued at the same time to coincide with a an organized ceremony to be held at Lakeshore and Bennett. The 100, or was it 200? I'm trying to think.
I didn't know that.
Might have been, you know, I don't remember the exact number now. It was either 1 or 200 invited guests were trained from Skagway to Bennett for that ceremony. First Nations representatives there as well, Mounties in uniform, us in our dress uniforms, the Parks Canada employees, and so lots of photos taken. And it was a great hands across the sea kind of thing. But it was really more, I think, intended to be symbolic of, you know, gee, we've got this trail that begins in the U.S., ends in Canada, and isn't this wonderful, and we're all kind of on, you know, singing from the same page. The significance of those proclamations still, I think, challenges anybody in park management. Not quite sure how thick that ice is. How far out can you go on that before it begins to crack? Or, you know, it's like, okay, how much can we do on the strength of this? And as far as I was concerned, this gave us a great deal of latitude. I won't say cover, but, you know, latitude to work hand in glove with Parks Canada in ensuring that our visitors, because they were, you know, they were ours and theirs, right. You know, our visitors were attended to and the resources protected. And so Tim and I, you know, were all on board to, and I think this predates my time there, so Tim, they've probably been doing this already, annual startup training, rough terrain rescue and travel, joint training between the Canadian wardens and the park rangers, was held first at Sheep Camp, and then the next year would be at Lindeman, based out of, you know, those locations, and then the next year back. So we just exchanged it back and forth, different, very different snow conditions, terrain, and so on. But the objective being the same is that, you know, to introduce the staffs to one another, have forced them to work together, to communicate, you know, to compare equipment, and we were setting up new repeater facilities and authorized them to operate on our radio frequencies. We probably didn't have any authority to do that, but we would just tell them, just do it. And, you know, because it made sense on the morning report. We instituted a morning report where we'd hear from each of the backcountry stations into headquarters whatever they had to report. Report in, what are you planning to do today, where are you going to go, what are the trail conditions, what are the snow conditions like, and so on. And all that was done on our radio frequency and on into the trail center in town that was staffed jointly by Parks Canada and NPS. So I supervised the NPS staff, and we had, depending upon who you were talking to on the Canadian side, one of two different supervisors as primary first line supervisors. So I was dealing with either their chief of interp, I guess you could call him, or their chief ranger.
And was Christine Hedgecock the chief ranger?
Glenn Cubian when I first arrived there, and Danver Hall pretty much the whole time that I worked there. Glenn was replaced by different individuals through time, but Danver Hall and I really became the primary go-betweens on a regular basis, on the phone to one another pretty frequently. And eventually when we were forced by a directive from our regional director to institute fees for the campground in Dyea, which we had not done previously, and for the U.S. side of the Chilkoot Trail, which we had not done. Canadians broke ground on that years before we did.
Before we can go any further, I wanted to make one note about the party that they had there at Bennett to celebrate.
The International Park
Yeah. Park Service and Parks Canada put together a big bronze plaque to commemorate that event. And they handed that plaque over to White Pass to put it up, but they never put it up. And the only reason I know that is that the office that I worked at White Pass, I saw this bronze plaque. I said, "What's that?" And Tina said, "Well, you know, White Pass had no intention of ever putting that up, so, you know, they didn't like Park Service or Park Canada, really." So there it sat. And then after she quit and I left, who knows whatever happened to that plaque.
So you never got it put up, even though you worked for White Pass?
Well, it wasn't my job. I was just an assistant, but it was, yeah, that's the point. There was nobody put in charge to put that plaque up, so
it's just another example of what is this and who's really in charge.
Right. There's yeah. no and one. White Pass had no love for the Park Service at all, or what Parks Canada.
And you so were working for, so Tina was head of public relations. Was Tina Sear?
Yeah, marketing. She was marketing. Yeah.
Marketing.
And so she worked 6 months there in Skagway, and I was her assistant full time. And then in the wintertime, she went down to Seattle or they go skiing. And so she needed somebody there just to open the mail and stuff. So I worked half time then her office in the wintertime. That was after Anha, when she stole me away from Anha. So, but anyway, there was a woman by the name of Glenda Choate, who was the historian for White Pass, and I worked with her some. She had tons of records that were in the red building, sometimes called the white building, that's on along the track just before you get to the railroad dock along there. And one half of that was just filled with all of her notes and books and all kinds of historical materials from White Pass. Mm-hmm. And she was trying to organize that. And then we met on the ferry to Juneau once, and on the way, you know, she wasn't feeling well, and I remember we got a motel together because we said, "Oh, let's get a motel." And I left real early in the morning, and I flew, and I hadn't seen her, and it turned out that she ended up going to the hospital and had cancer and died soon after.
Wow.
Yeah. It was really weird. And she told me a bunch of secret stuff, you know, about Skagway and people. And, you know, it was amazing. She had an amazing array of stories. I don't know if you ever were able to interview her.
No, I know her name, but I don't know. She may have been interviewed by somebody else in the past.
Yeah, it was amazing. She had file cabinets there in my office, and that's where that plaque was, right next to it. So she knew about it, but I don't know. You know, it was kind of like physically moving that thing was so huge. It must have weighed 100 pounds. And, you know, no one in the administrative offices could even lift it. And so it would have been for, like, the maintenance away or Ed or somebody to put that up. And they had no use for anyone. And there was this huge schism in White Pass between the people that worked on the train and the people in the office.
Right. Now, since we're talking about history, you do this, or you have been doing this history blog, a Skagway history blog?
Yeah, skagwaystories.org. And there's like 700 stories or something there. Because when I worked for the city during the winter, I had very little to do. Buckwheat was very...
So you worked for the Visitor Convention Bureau.
Yes,
right.
For the city of Skagway. And so I kept the visitor center open throughout the winter. And so I looked for a project, and that was the project that I did. I did the blog, which was a story every day. And it, generally, I would, after I put together the database, then I could look at, like, I could change it to the day of the. And so, like, for instance, for July 25th, when it was July 25th, I'd look and see, well, what happened this day? And sometimes it would be an event. Other times it might just be somebody was born. And then I would look up about that person, and then I would write about that one person on that day. So a lot of times it would start out on this day, July 25th, 1840, so-and-so was born. Mr. Berberides, you know, ran a thing. And so that's how people would find me, relatives, descendants of these people. And I get one, usually one a week still.
Really?
Yeah, because I talked about so many different people, and very often they'll say, oh, I just saw your story. What else do you have on my great-grandfather? And I have to tell them, you know, I don't even remember writing that at all. And I would generally, on each story, I'll put a note as to where I got the information. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I didn't, because I didn't remember to do it. But it was just kind of a daily thing that I did. And it was kind of exciting to do that.
So Arlen was her webmaster, essentially.
Right. Yeah, you set me up.
Set her up, and so... There's no commercial, there's no advertising, right. There's no commercial aspect
to it. So Arlen pays, he has a domain, and it's on that domain, so he...
So you started it for the city of Skagway, and then you just kept doing it on your own?
I started it, for the city, not so much for the city. Well, I actually started it so that some of the stories that the interpreters and the guides were telling were way off base. I mean, you know, they would talk about... people that had done, you know, church work, and then they would say, oh yeah, this was a whore that was running, you know, this, and I mean, it would be like so, and that really annoyed me, you know, so I thought, okay, well, I need to have, you know, these short stories, so they're short, couple paragraphs that straighten out the story about this person, so that if a tour guide wanted to write just ghost stories, he could read all the ghost stories, or, there's one section about just the Gold Rush Cemetery, you know, who's buried there, and history of those.
Most of those have a picture attached to them.
They have some kind of a picture.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Unless it has no picture related. And a lot of times, relatives have sent me pictures, I've posted them.
Right. Now, you said you looked up in some database. What was it?
That was the database that I put together.
Which is what, a database of what?
Of
these stories?
No, the database was the 3,700 people or something. That was the combination of the death index, the 1900 census, the 1910 census, the 1920 census, the 1930 census. All of those censuses, the death, and then the birth records, as well as records regarding the cemeteries. Who, you know, were there. There was lots of lists that I found in books, online, and old newspapers. There was photos with attributes underneath. There was one picture that I just recently got that was in Carcross in the little visitor center there of several Sikhs that were working on the White Pass Railroad, and I actually just took a picture with my camera, posted that, and said, who knew?
Right.
You know, unusual things like that. I don't have any names for those. And then there was even a story about from New Zealand, Maoris that came, a group of, I think it was 30 Maoris that came and climbed the White Pass. You never hear about that.
Right.
And I had a number of names, and I tried contacting a university professor to say, can you tell me if these names are Maori names or not? And they both shied away. They said, well, we really can't tell. Hmm. But anyway, so those were all on this database, this Excel database that I have is huge. And it has all of that information. Like I said, the Park Service printed it out at one point. And that's what they use when people come into the desk, which they do every day, and say, my great-great-grandfather came, and his name was Joe Blow. And they say, well, let's look it up under B. There he is, you know, and they'll have a little bit of information, which I found and put together.
That's a huge amount of research that you must have done.
Well, I did it every day. That's what I did.
For years.
Because I had absolutely no other duties. Buckwheat wouldn't give me anything else to do.
Well, you're supposed to answer the phone.
Well, the phone rang maybe twice a day. And, I wanted to coordinate events, but he didn't want me to do anything like that because he wanted to get a second position, to kind of build the kingdom there. And so that never happened.
We should say it's Buckwheat Donahoe. Donahue.
Robert Carlin Donahue.
And who was head of the visitor center?
He was the
Convention and Visitor Bureau Director.
Something. He was the director, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I ran the visitor center downstairs. So he was upstairs in his office.
So are you still adding to the Skagway stories?
I do occasionally. Not as much. I used to do it every day.
Right.
So I have to admit that I only do it maybe once a month, if that. I should do it more often, but...
Well, you're retired.
But I can look at the numbers. What's it called? The graphic numbers. And I get 30 people a day.
Oh, for the stats.
Yeah, the stats. I can look at it, and 30 people a day look at my blog. It's amazing.
Wow.
I mean, 30 isn't a lot, but it's better than a poke in the eye.
Yeah.
So
yeah, you did a lot of work then with sort of the tourism side with ANHA and then the visitor convention.
Yeah, so I worked for the city there for 7 years. And then when I retired, like the day after I made my 7 years, because I wanted out. But in the summertime, it was very busy, obviously. So I supervised, you know, 3 or 4 people behind the desk. And then I had my little corner there, which is still where Wendy is now. And pretty much that's all we did was, you know, make sure the bathrooms were functioning and hand out,
well,
you know,
a lot of talking brochures. To people.
Yeah, and so that's why Scott Holm worked for me,
mm-hmm.
Charles, I can never remember his last name. He's still there. He's not doing very well. Dimitra,
mm-hmm.
And various other people that would kind of come and go, you know.
Did you enjoy working with the tourists?
Yeah, yeah. You know, it was interesting. You know, if I needed to, I'd work behind the desk, and you know, tell people stories. Most of the time, I'd find out where they were from. You know, people love to talk about themselves,
yeah.
And you know, and it was very interesting. I always was able to. Relate where they were from or what they were doing to something that I had visited or knew about.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah. And occasionally we'd have people come in year after year, and they would bring me artifacts. They brought me some amazing artifacts for A.B. Hall, like a flag that had flown there, and they brought me membership cards for the Arctic Brotherhood,
uh-huh.
And I had those framed. They've taken them down now. I think they don't go with the interior the way they want to put it in the back. And some of the more valuable things I ended up loaning to the Park Service from the city.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, I could have taken them with me because I heard that they were giving away the display cases in the back of AB Hall, and that's where I put a lot of those artifacts, so I don't
mm-hmm.
even know what happened to them. But
maybe they're in the City Museum.
It's possible that some of that stuff may have gone over to Judy.
Yeah. So did you like living in Skagway in the small town?
No. I grew up in L.A., and I had a lot of, you know, you live in a city and you have a lot of options. And especially in Southern California, you have sun, you know, all the time, and freedom to go and do things. And I mean, I work different jobs, and then, you know, working certainly helps and take your mind off the fact that it's cold and dark and you can't really exercise because there's no place to go. And then they kind of improved the rec center, so that helped some. But in general, yeah, I'd have to say that all four of us were suffering from depression and from lack of vitamin D, and I think that contributed to the depression.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're so depressed, you don't even tell each other. So Reed and I and the boys were each depressed in our own way and dealt with it in different ways. And, you know, looking back on it, we recognize it now.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, we just felt angry. So, I wouldn't do it again.
Yeah, I mean, you guys lived there for a long time.
We did.
Under those conditions, other people might have left.
Well, we couldn't because Reed was locked into his job.
I was wearing the golden handcuffs.
So until he could retire, we couldn't leave. And so that made it really, really kind of tough. But, you know, I have to say that, you know, the friends that we made there are the only friends really that we have. You know, and so we see them as they come through. They'll stay with us. When we go up there, we visit with them. It's odd, but when you live in a small town, you get to know almost everybody. I mean, especially because Reed and I worked at different, he worked, you know, in different, the fire department and chamber of commerce. And I worked in the police and ANHA and park service and
Presbyterian Church.
Then we, the school, you know, so we had connections with so many different organizations that we got to know a lot of people.
When I was saying, having kids in school, you got to meet other families probably.
That more than anything else,
I mean, because the boys would bring home other kids sometimes for study nights or whatever, and
So how is it that you were locked in to the job? You couldn't get a Park Service job someplace else?
Because of the disconnect with my law enforcement past, I could no longer apply for any other ranger job with law enforcement. So those were closed to me.
Okay.
I didn't have a history or background, a professional at my grade level in anything else. In the Park Service, I mean, I could have done any number of different things, but I wasn't going to be in a position to compete effectively in any other field. And then if you look at concessions, which is maybe would have been the closest one, the opportunities would have been more or less Anchorage, San Francisco, Denver, I mean, a big city somewhere. And I couldn't see that moving, uprooting us and moving us from Skagway to Anchorage into that regional office was actually going to be an improvement.
And when we retired, they would not have paid for a move back to the lower 48. They would have paid for a move back to Skagway.
Oh.
Right. Not, actually, they wouldn't even have done that.
Right.
So as it was, not only were we locked into Skagway, that's sort of my view of it, is that in order to maintain the pay level, and there's more complexities to that as well, which I won't go into here, I don't think we have time, but in order to do that, and at the time of retirement, you had a limited window during which we could see a paid move back to the lower 48, which was a really big deal. If you live in one place in one house for 15 years, you collect a lot of stuff.
Right.
And we kicked out a lot of stuff, gave it away, sold it cheap in town. A lot.
Right.
And we still had nine tons of household goods leave Alaska with us and came south here, and we've sold some since then. We've gained some more back, but you know, we're kind of collectors, so here we have those are big factors for us in deciding when and where we go somewhere.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the Chilkoot Trail and your responsibilities and duties of that. You mentioned the morning reports and working with the Canadian wardens, but as chief ranger, what kind of responsibilities did you have regarding the trail?
Tim Stidell was my right-hand man for, he was the primary go-to for anybody for Chilkoot Trail operations. There's no doubt of that. And Tim and I, thankfully, hit it off right from the start. We had a very similar perspective on the nature of park ranger work, the broad view of skill sets that we want from, and we especially saw eye to eye on what the backcountry rangers were, what role, what purpose that they served, who we wanted to hire. And so while Tim would do the hiring, we'd go through the application, do the selections, I trusted that he was looking for, and we were filling positions that were generalist ranger positions. Among the last, I might add, in the Park Service, it seemed like, that because they weren't intended to be strictly interpretive. They did some interpretive work. They certainly weren't law enforcement certified or trained, but they were meant to be our eyes and ears on the trail for enforcement purposes. They're there for educational purposes, preventative purposes, and so on. So we really wanted somebody who was kind of viewed themselves as a public safety ranger. And that's what Tim hired, were public safety rangers. And we loved that. The problem was that the system was squeezing us more and more. We really weren't able to continue to do that. And when it came time to, we had to make a decision, we're going to hire protection seasonals, the challenges of trying to get those individuals certified and qualified and finally able to receive a law enforcement commission. Sometimes it would be midsummer, late summer.
Yeah.
And what's the point?
Yeah.
We just spent a lot of money that didn't really return anything. And in one case, we actually got to the middle of the summer, and by that time, nobody trusted the individual with a commission, even though we got to the point where we could have given him one.
Mm-hmm.
We actually instead terminated him, like let him go. People were scared to have him around. They didn't want to hand him a gun.
Right.
So it became more and more challenging, and we, I think, shifted more and more to the idea that we're going to have to hire permanent, subject to furlough, invest more in fewer positions, fewer individuals. So it was an evolutionary process there as well, but thankfully Tim and I, again, seemed to really see eye to eye in how things worked. Preventative search and rescue is also known as PSAR in the business, and that was the primary role and function, in my view, of the trail center operations, the trail permitting, and the backcountry facilities along the way, was to prevent the need for rescues. And thankfully, we kept them really to a remarkably small number, the number of people that had to be flown off.
Mm-hmm.
I'm surprised at how, it could have happened a lot more often than
right.
it did. So a lot of what we did was prepare. I worked with Tim at one point. I said, our plan was we'll put a rescue cache at the scales, because if somebody's going to get injured, that's probably where it's going to happen. They're going to need to be flown off from there, but the weather may not allow. And so they may have to bivouac there for some time. We want a cache there that a ranger can arrive to, pull food, heat, shelter out of. Got that set up. We also had an area cleared in kind of the gravel bar area, the river near Canyon City, as an emergency heli spot, because again, we had very few areas where you could actually bring a helicopter in, and that was one. Finnegan's Point on the gravel bar, we figured if the river's down enough, we could land in, have somebody land in there. But of course, when I say we, it's Temsco helicopters. Those kinds of rescues typically were staffed by the fire department. So a fire department EMS volunteer would board the helicopter in Skagway, fly to the site, meet the ranger who would call them in, and then transfer the patient individual to the care of the fire department employee, and they'd be transported back in the helicopter. They get charged by Temsco when they get in and at the clinic for their ambulance trip and so on. So it wasn't cheap, but it wasn't costing us. And our role was just to call them in and then to have them flown off. In some cases, that meant in the middle of the night getting a radio call from a visitor who'd gone lame up and broken into the Summit Warden Station. Hello, hello, I need help. And for us to scramble someone from sheep camp. At least once I remember just holding my breath, because it was well after dark. We had a ranger who had legs like tree trunks. Guy was amazing. And he made a 45-minute run from Sheep Camp to the Summit Warden Station. God. In the dark. Amazing yeah. individual. He basically provided initial care for this person, stabilized, made an assessment, called that out. You know, we made arrangements for the next morning for a helicopter evacuation. That, of course, meant coordinating with customs on
because it was on both the sides. Canadian side.
On the Canadian side, you have to contact a Canada Border Services Agency office and the U.S. Customs, both. So, and, you know, they've got to know what's going on, give their approval, and the weather's got to cooperate, and TEMSCO's got to free up a helicopter. Now, remember, TEMSCO's here to serve tourists. That's right, to fly tours. That's the money. They don't, sure, they're going to get paid for their flight, but they'll lose money in the proposition for that helicopter to be out of the. So they were always kind of like, okay, do we have to?
Well, were there times where they couldn't go because of weather?
Sure. Yeah.
Then what?
And then you have to, you hope that you've got somebody bivouacked someplace where they've got shelter and somebody's there to provide, make sure they, you know, heat, light, water.
You never had anybody die up on the trail?
No, thankfully.
Did Carl Gerke tell you about his appendicitis thing?
I don't remember.
He, you know, that a few years ago, they couldn't fly out of Skagway, and he diagnosed himself as having appendicitis. So he got on the ferry, and he ferried to Juneau, and then he took a taxi to the hospital.
Carl's self-rescue.
Appendectomy, didn't tell anybody.
And he made it?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's still
he's
here.
Lucky. No, but I mean, it didn't burst en route. No.
What happens with it? My son had an appendicitis, and it doesn't actually burst. It starts to dissolve, and the more it dissolves, the more infection fills
the peritoneum.
So then it takes a while to flush all of that bad stuff out, so that's why.
We had circumstances where somebody had come over the summit, over the pass there, they passed the warden station, and there's a, you know, you saw normally a snow-covered slope that leads right on down to Crater Lake there. Well, you know, at a certain time, you've got a crust of ice on that, and at least once, maybe twice that I can recall, somebody slip on that and slide high speed all the way down and hit the rocks at the bottom.
This is where I took cleats with me.
So that's a circumstance. The instructions provided to our staff, and thankfully, similarly on the Canadian side, was that do not hesitate if you receive a call or if we receive it, we will dispatch you. Do not hesitate to cross the border for an emergency call like that. I said, the only thing you can do wrong is hesitate or fail to respond to that, and to be the first responder there. Because no one's going to care which side of the border that person is on. If you're the closest person, you get there first. And when the Canadians can muster sufficient forces that they can relieve the emergency, they can take over, then you can withdraw. And similarly, we had times when the Canadian wardens would make the run down to Sheep Camp in response to someone that, you know, had become injured or ill, and we didn't have somebody available.
Right. And now would TEMSCO fly up and over and rescue somebody in Canada?
With our, what we would do is call we would confirm Canada, you know, that Parks Canada says we don't have a warden nearby, or we know, or they were making the call for the evacuation. As long as Parks Canada, you know, made the call, said yes, this is what we want to happen, then we would call the Canada Border Services Agency, and the border station on each side of the border, say we have an emergency call, need for evacuation, we have staff on scene, and once they gave their thumbs up, and we could launch, we could tell TEMSCO, you get your fire department volunteer on board and make the flight. then they could make the evacuation back to Skagway.
Because the Parks Canada didn't have access to a helicopter on their side.
Well, they did and had done that. They were under some pressure, I suspect, for political reasons as much as anything else. Under the right circumstances, the expectation would be that they would call in a helicopter from Whitehorse, but it was a longer delay.
Yeah.
And so if the nature of the emergency were such that someone needed immediate care, if it was more serious, they knew the wrong thing to do would be to wait for, so.
Well, as you said, the Golden Staircase, that summit climb, is most likely the place where someone's going to get hurt.
Right.
Not always. I mean, someone has a heart attack, they could have it anywhere on the trail, but...
Sure, yeah. We were most fortunate, it seemed to me, because we took, on both sides of the border, and took great pains, and you experienced this personally, to drive home the whole safe travel in bear country. Just relentlessly. And then having staff in the backcountry on both sides to re-emphasize those messages meant that we really had very few circumstances where people did stupid things and, left their can of tuna out on the picnic table or, that kind of thing where they lured an animal in with. It happened very rarely. Occasionally people were bluff charged and there were big scares, the rangers would respond with a shotgun. So we would keep shotguns and ammunition in both of our backcountry stations, same at Lindeman. And it, that meant that the protocol was to have two individuals respond, if at all possible, one loaded with less than lethal rounds and the other with lethal rounds, to haze a bear. Mm-hmm. And they were successful at hazing occasionally. It's very difficult to do, as you probably know, because you actually got to catch the bear doing something for it to mean anything.
Right.
Yeah. And so that's the hard part. And it usually didn't happen.
I mean, my hike on the trail this last summer, the only time we saw a ranger on the U.S. side was at sheep camp.
Right, okay.
And on the Parks Canada side, maybe there was somebody at the summit in the shelter we did go in, I don't know, in the cabin. Happy Camp.
Was there somebody at Happy Camp?
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Well, they might have been on their way to the Warden Station or just hiked on back down to Happy Camp from the Warden Station.
Maybe. I mean, they were there overnight, so.
I'm going to go to bed.
Okay.
And I made your bed.
Well, it seemed to me, was one of the most delightful discoveries that I had on arriving here, because I guess I, like so many others, really didn't understand the dynamic landscape, the scope and the length, the fact that it was a destination backpack trip for a couple thousand people a year. I just became enchanted by that. And really worked hard to try and make sure that we had open relations with Parks Canada. When we began the business of the jointly issued backcountry permit.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, did that happen during your tenure?
It did. And under duress, if you will, the regional director said, why aren't we charging fees for that? The Canadians are. It's like, because it's a pain in the butt. Which it is, collecting fees anytime. Yeah. So the plan was to make this one-stop shopping. One permit, one reservation, one fee. It's like, you don't have to, not this business of call this office for that one and then coordinate for that. We knew it could turn into a nightmare. We also knew that the Canadians were way ahead of us in this game. They've been doing it for a few years. So they had some of the infrastructure already together. So it only made sense in my book to say, can we piggyback on this in such a, will you collect our fees for us and basically, twice a year remit those back to us? Just partition out what you think is hard. And we had to agree on each year what those would be, what because percentage? They were charging them in dollars Canadian. And so what I would have to do is do a cost comparison by calling other parks, doing online research, basically just finding out, hey, what other backcountry permits for backcountry use run, and then we'll try and set ours in that realm using a comparable fee. Being cognizant of the fact that the combined fee is what people are going to see. It's not just the one versus the other. So each year I would do that, and then I would call Denver Hall and I'd tell them, okay, A, this is what we want to see for our part of the fee for this year. Secondly, he and I would have to agree on the fixed rate of exchange that they would program into right. their cash registers and what they would use. So basically, how would they take U.S. currency? You know,
right.
because of course that changes minute to minute, second to second, practically. They couldn't deal with that. We couldn't deal with that. I said, so
just pick the rate.
Each January, Dan and I would get on the phone and, you know, put your finger in the air and say, I kind of think let's, and we would just, right. we would more or less arbitrarily set an agreed upon exchange rate.
Right.
And once we agreed on that on the phone, Dan would act on it, move forward. We would usually put that into, I would put that into a memorandum of call or something along right. those lines that would then be signed by the superintendent, acknowledging and then copying the Canadian. So, okay, we're all, this is, we've huddled, this is what we agreed on. When we first proposed doing this, the regional chief of administration, what was his name, Tom? God, what a kick in the pants he was. He tells me, he says, well, I don't know that that's going to work. You're not going to be able to do that. What happens when the first super patriotic weenie complains about the fact that he's going to be charged for a backcountry permit in the U.S. in dollars Canadian? You know? And I said, Tom, just let us try it. It's like, I have a feeling that people get it.
Yeah.
They're not going to want to do this twice. And they know they're going into Canada.
Right.
It's like, I think it'll work. And he just threw up his hands and kind of said, all right, fine, knock yourselves out. He says,
it's on you if it doesn't
work. Yeah, exactly. It's on you if it doesn't work. And thankfully, worked famously. I don't think we ever had a complaint from anybody. Anybody that wanted to backpack the Chilkoot, that was a pretty select group.
Yeah.
It was a pretty select group of people that said, I am in this. I want to do this. And I'm really happy that I only have to call one office.
Right.
And so in the winter, they could call Parks Canada. In the summer, they'd call the Trail Center. They'd get one of our staff members, didn't matter which agency. And it was kind of a little odd that at times it was just our staff in the Trail Center collecting dollars Canadian for a backcountry permit. And thankfully, people seem to approve. They seem to approve of this cooperative approach, the venture that, you know what, we're working towards the same goal, we're using more or less the same methods, we're just coordinated.
I mean, it does seem a little odd when you're hiking the Chilkoot to call Parks Canada.
Yeah. And I think that in the off season, you know, when, you call in January or February or whatever, and you say, oh, hey, wait a minute, I'm starting in the U.S. Why am I calling Whitehorse?
Right.
You know, and I'm talking to someone whose English is...
Who has a French accent.
Yes, who has a French accent. Well, thankfully, again, there seems to be a really strong desire on the part of all the staff to give a thorough measure of service. And so we just really haven't had anybody, you know, kind of throw down on that and say, gee, I can't live with that. You know, we really need you to...
Well, and it is also interesting that in, you know,
the current age, there is no website to go sign up to get your permit. You have to do it by telephone.
Yeah.
I think you get more pushback on that if now. I mean,
if people thought that there were, you know, a way to do that, I imagine, you know, they probably push harder. Maybe they are pushing harder, and I'm just not aware of it.
I don't know.
But from the perspective of the staff wanting to really understand that you understand what it is you think you're going to be doing, mm-hmm. I think the telephone connection does that better than just having somebody sign up on the...
And I can say, as a hiker who found the logistics very complicated,
mm-hmm.
of where to go and stop and then connecting with the train,
mm-hmm.
having somebody have it all figured out for me,
yeah.
was way easier than if I'd had to figure it out on a website.
Yes. I think you're right. And that's why I would, if anybody asked me, I would say, no, don't convert to some automated system that will create a lot of havoc. You won't know how that will express itself.
I mean, maybe once the woman who's on the other end of the phone retires and isn't there because she was so good,
yeah.
maybe then she'd only could be replaced by an automated system. I don't know.
Our practice was to try and ensure that the individuals that answer the phone, if at all possible, it was not always possible, but if at all possible, to have those individuals be veterans of hiking the trail.
Right.
That they've at least done it once, so that when they spoke to somebody on the phone, they could speak with the confidence and assurance.
Right.
Okay, I know what I'm talking about. I've actually seen it, and I'm not just blowing smoke.
And now your experience is on the trail. Did you get to experience it?
I got to hike the trail, but not really fairly, I guess is what I'd say, because I stayed in the backcountry stations when I would hike the trail. So I would carry a pack, I would carry my supplies, but I didn't necessarily have to carry a sleeping pad,
or
a tent.
Right.
Right, exactly. So, you know, yeah, it was not the same experience by any stretch, but I could see the trail from end to end. I could actually see what the facilities were like. We could talk to the staff on the Canadian side as well as the U.S. and say, gee, this is, and really get a much better notion as to athletically, what does this demand of people, you know, this between these two camps, mm-hmm. or, you know, what's it like getting to the train, you know, on time.
So did you do it once every year?
Once a year, yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I tried to do. I'm sure I didn't hit every year, but... 1 year, let's see, 1 or 2 years, I actually took one of my sons with me, and in general, if I hiked it, then my counterpart would hike it, so the chief ranger on their side, mm-hmm. the two of us would go together, so okay. It wasn't just me, and usually it would be like Tim and Glenn, myself, never Dan Verhall, so maybe the three of us, sometimes the superintendents on both sides, mm-hmm. The general superintendent on the Canadian side, and the U.S. On the U.S. side, the superintendent. So sometimes we'd have a group of three. One time we had Department of Interior individual, Cal, what was his name? He and his wife came along. You know, that was kind of a VIP trip, I guess you'd call it. You know, so the purpose and function, the way it operated, it varied from year to year. Occasionally, it would be just myself and another ranger to maybe do the U.S. side.
Mm-hmm.
I remember getting from Sheep Camp to the Summit Warden Station, halfway up the scales, up above mm-hmm. the scales, the fog and the rain had got to the point where I realized that normally I would hike in shorts
mm-hmm.
because you're generating so much heat. And I got halfway up and realized even doing this, I'm not generating enough heat. I'm getting really cold. Yeah. And I'm going to remember pulling on the rest of my pants and like trying to, thinking, you know, this can turn really, really bad, really fast.
So you learned what the hikers experience.
Yeah. You know, and then I turned around and came,
or you hiked came back down.
But, you know, I'm carrying a day pack, right. not a full on. And recognizing that, okay, trying to do that in the rain and the fog, coming down that slope, if you had any weight up high, right, backpackers typically do, that's not safe. And it's during those traverses into and out of, at times, that I concluded and still strongly feel that anybody that is trail running, regardless of whether they are very careful about choosing the weather in which they run, which they always say, gee, you know, I wait until this time of year and it's wonderful, you know, and then I watch the weather, they're hanging it out so far, they're asking for a debilitating injury or a bear attack. I mean, that's my take on it. It's like, how it hasn't happened is...
Knock on wood.
So it was a wonderful experience, and the Canadians were terrific to work with. Sometimes our biggest challenge was just arranging for housing for the Canadian in Skagway for the summer. Somebody working getting the payments from Parks Canada was not difficult at all. They cut a check twice a year, and then we would just deposit that.
You had said, I think it was before we were recording, about your first view of the trail.
My first view of the trail was on my very first day on the job, and I was told to hustle down to Temscoe Helicopters, which at the time was only a block from the headquarters, and not in its current location, but it was on Broadway on the south side of the tracks. There's a little house where tour sales are done now. That was the Temscoe office.
Wow.
And behind that, the open field behind that is where the helicopters were landing. And so as the helicopters would come in to make their sweep and land, the rotor chop would vibrate the windows there in the office. It was quite the circus.
Yeah.
But they said, run on down to Temscoe, meet John Warder, chief of maintenance there, and he's going to fly the trail spring pre-opening. He wants to see how much tree fall there's been. He wants to see if any bridges have been damaged. He wants to look at the footings at one particular bridge, and you should go along with him and check it out. So I jumped in the helicopter. It was a cloudy, it was an overcast day, typical spring, and not too windy, but flying up at a fairly low elevation because John wanted to see as much as he could see from the that was a flight unlike I think one I ever made up the trail after that and then Warder had the pilot land near this suspension bridge and in so doing I realized we just made a full power vertical landing straight down through the tree canopy to the gravel bed of the creek bed, the river bed.
It's
there.
Not very wide.
Not
those
very
openings.
Wide, and big cobbles in the bed there, and eroded stream bank, and it took him about 4 or 5, maybe 6 tries testing, slowly allowing the weight of the helicopter to compress the gravel underneath. And then he would not be satisfied. He'd only be partially set and then lift off a foot, shift over a few inches, and then drop down again, and then allow the weight of the helicopter to... until he was finally, after about the fifth or sixth time, satisfied that it would support the helicopter, he allowed the full weight of the helicopter to come down to rest and to allow the engine to cool and then shut down. I thought, This is my first visit to the Chilkoot Trail by helicopter, and in circumstances that were pretty demanding for any helicopter pilot. Yeah. That was very impressive.
Yeah, I'd say he was a good pilot.
Yeah.
And so the trail crew itself, that was all under chief of maintenance. You were not supervising them.
The trail maintenance crew was under the chief of maintenance, and they had a separate backcountry cabin.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if you had an opportunity to see that. If you leave the Canyon City cabin,
mm-hmm.
when you start, very soon you get to a nearly, like vertical.
Right.
It's like a switchback.
Switchbacks up.
Okay. Right. At the top of that, if you break away from the trail and head about 150, 200 feet out into the trees and a little further up, there's another cabin.
I don't think I noticed it.
There's another cabin there, and that's the trail maintenance crew cabin.
Huh.
They were pretty careful not to, like, beat a trail to it because they really didn't want people showing up there at that.
No.
Because, it has a helicopter landing deck there at that cabin.
Mm-hmm. For all their supplies.
Supplies coming in. The annual airlift of supplies into each of those backcountry stations was a pretty substantial affair. Normally, each of the employees was given the opportunity to buy. Anybody that was going to be stationed in the backcountry could buy as many groceries as they thought they could afford and that would keep. We would pack those into nets, boxes into nets, and those were then flown by a sling load into each of those two stations. At the same time, usually, not always, but then any lumber loads, gravel loads, any other materials that were being flown up. So that flight, those supply flight days were big deals, mobilizing everybody in maintenance and in the Ranger crew. As you'd expect, the concern was always about loads being secured well, flying well, safe operations beginning to end. Normally we'd have individuals standing by at each of those locations as ground, basically landing zone managers, and the same down at the Temsco end. And we learned a very valuable lesson one day when I was at the town end for loads outgoing, and we had a big net load on a trailer, and they had just got some new cargo nets. Very long lead lines.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't really quite familiar with. And standing under the helicopter, doing the hookup on this, when the helicopter started to lift on this, one of those leads wrapped around one of my legs.
Oh no.
And as the load came off the ground and the line slapped against the load, it pinned my leg up against the load, and there was no one on the ground watching. And so I got lifted off the ground.
Gosh.
I got lifted and completely off the ground before the helicopter pilot, looking out, realized that I was dangling from his load. And he gently put me back down. I walked away from the load and said, okay, you can go now. And ever after that incident, I said, we will have two individuals on the departure location. We also, Scott Logan actually came up with it's a brilliant idea, very simple. Went over to the hardware store and bought an inner tube for a wheelbarrow, a small inner tube, and I would slide that as a choker down on those lead lines, and hold it tight to the load. It was so it was a good preventative measure there, and then we added a spotter on the ground, in radio communications with the pilot, and it's like, okay, if anything goes wrong, we've got somebody here who's watching.
So you weren't able to untie yourself because you were the pressure from the line going up?
Correct. My leg was pinned, was wrapped and pinned,
uh-huh.
and I'm now upside down.
Oh, I see.
And just hanging. So there's no, it's no untying yourself.
Yeah, right.
I sort of had this vision of somehow becoming disentangled somewhere over Dai, you know.
You just ended up
I'd be out there in the slide cemetery.
That's what you're saying. Just dropped you off in exactly. The slide cemetery. Man, that sounds scary. Yeah. One thing we haven't talked about, which I want to ask, is this Seattle unit. Just, mm-hmm. you know, because you were in the administrative end, and there, how much connection was there, if any, between Skagway and the Seattle unit?
There were attempts. There were attempts at that, and certainly, I'd say, varying degrees of success. To the best of my knowledge, superintendents made an effort ordinarily to make a visit of some kind. I have to admit, I never actually visited the Seattle unit. I occasionally might be on a conference call with others where someone from the Seattle unit and beyond. Primarily, it came up, at least in my experience, relative to discussions about what does the International Historical Park mean? What did we want it to mean? Where is this going? And so I don't know that I ever felt like we answered that well.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was like, well, we're not really sure, and there's no funding, and nobody's really suggesting we change all the maps in the country and officially change the name of the... As I mentioned earlier in our conversation, I took it to mean that we had a license to do things with Parks Canada
mm-hmm.
that otherwise might have been viewed as a lot more sketchy. Joint communications, joint operations, fee collection, you know, coordinating publications, jointly paying for this map.
Right.
We paid for part of the press run. The Canadians would pay for the other
but
part of the press
Seattle
run.
The Seattle unit was not involved. Were they part of the international park?
Yes. It's part of the... And you could say that, to some degree, they were kind of on the same footing as Dawson was viewed as part of the same story.
Right.
Tells the other end of the story, right?
Right.
Well, are they actually part of the... Well, not...
They're not really not, physically connected.
No. And okay. Is there really a boundary right. of the International Historical Park that... Well, we don't have a boundary map,
right.
per se. This graphic that I showed right. you here, if you look closer, you'd find... You know, it's marked International Historical
right.
Park, okay? But it, of course, focuses on the Chilkoot Trail right. unit.
Right.
Of...
And the White Pass unit.
On the Canadian side, Chilkoot Trail National Historic Site.
Right.
Of Canada. That's the full name.
Right. So, yeah, and the fact that the Seattle unit was in a different region...
Mm-hmm.
Did that complicate that things?
And it certainly didn't help.
Yeah.
you know, not having had occasion in my work to kind of force me mm-hmm. into that. I think if the park organization chart had stayed as simple as it was when I first arrived there, it would have been very different. It would have been mm-hmm. probably more like, there isn't really anybody else to champion this. The superintendent really is the one that needs to champion this. And I think there were efforts made to do just that. But
I would have thought that interp staff on both parks, that the historical staff and the interpretation staff, that's where the collaborations could have happened.
I agree. And I think that that's what I had to conclude, was that my focus was on operations and, you know, that this is not part of our operational scope.
Right.
This is telling the story.
Right.
And if you're one of those that tells the story, you know, you're going to include those pieces. You
right.
can't help it.
Right. There was something that just thought about that. Now I forgot. You might have something that you wrote down.
We covered a lot of one thing I wanted to mention in reference to Chilkoot Trail operations, a remarkable thing, when I first arrived, the first few summer seasons, one of the trail rangers was a woman named Nancy Shave. And Nancy was a truly remarkable person, very giving person. And Skagway Volunteer Fire Department advanced EMT with the fire department, and she responded to every incident that she could, you know, I mean, anything that came up. But working for us, she worked at sheep camp. So she would go up, just like the backcountry rangers mm-hmm. always would go up to sheep camp, but she was in her mid-50s.
Wow.
And here I arrived in my early 40s, and I knew that, okay, well, I'm not working at the level I used to, and she's in her mid-50s, and, you know, that's a heck of a hike to sheep camp, and then from sheep camp to the summit, which is typically what you want to see
that's
the ranger staff to do. You know, what it became apparent, well, no, she's not actually doing that every day, and she's not even doing that every other day. She's staying mostly in sheep camp and waiting, and, you know, would talk with hikers and do interpretive programs and pick blueberries and make pies and, mm-hmm. you know, make people. She was a hospitality. Her view of the job was somewhat different than ours, and yet she was an advanced EMT. Mm-hmm. We didn't employ her as an advanced EMT, so we didn't authorize her to perform at that level. And so if something happened on the trail, she almost immediately defaulted back to her certification and training for the fire department mm-hmm. over my objections, because I'd say, you know, this isn't part of your position right. description.
But once you're trained in that, that's your first responder instinct taking over, probably.
Yes, and she felt that it would be an abandonment of the patient if she didn't perform right. to the full level of her other training. Well, so there was an inherent conflict here. And then the helicopter at times would arrive and she would leave with the helicopter because as an advanced EMT, she couldn't turn her patient over to a basic EMT.
Oh.
So if the helicopter arrives with a fire department volunteer at a lower certification level, she would get on board and leave her duty station in the backcountry.
At sheep camp.
At sheep camp. And I'd find her in town. And she would have accompanied the patient in on a private helicopter that was not an NPS flight. And she was in her NPS uniform. And I it's like my hair would curl. It's like, Nancy, this is, you know, like violates every legal underpinning. You know, if something goes wrong, you will be deemed to be working outside of the scope of your employment. And you better darn well hope that the city of Skagway is there to catch you. You know, that they will come to your defense.
As the EMT.
If there's a legal challenge, if there's anything that goes haywire, anything, you know, I mean, yeah, you're not working within the... And so there was always this tension, and she would just kind of brush it off. It's like, I'll do what I need to do. And I thought, you know, you are just a force to be reckoned with. So her husband, Frank Wasmer, was also a captain on the volunteer fire department, worked for the city of Skagway, and just like everybody else in town, wore 2, 3, 4 different hats. And that was part of my introduction to, okay, you've got to figure out how to work with this.
Right.
You know, figure out how to make it work. Eventually, Nancy had, for personal reasons, decided she wasn't going to come back finally one summer and told us as much in the spring, said, I'm not going to be able to work this summer. And Tim and I said, oh, that's so terrible, Nancy. And secretly inside, of course, we were both doing handsprings because we were thinking, ah, okay, nothing bad happened right. as account of this. We've escaped with, you know. As a side note, Nancy later proved to everyone the value of the EMS system that she helped put in place in Skagway. When her heart stopped in the theater, in the park headquarters,
whoa.
At Christmas. Not Christmas Day, but yeah, Yuletide.
Should, yeah, have that Yuletide celebration.
Right. Thing. So during Yuletide, you know, it was a screening of a movie there, and it was everybody from town was in there. It was like, it was packed. And Frank sitting next to her realized that she'd gone unconscious, and they realized that very quickly, got her on the floor, her heart had stopped, she'd stopped breathing. The AED unit that we had at the front counter was whisked up, same with the oxygen cylinder. Volunteers stepped forward, people went to work there, the call went out, ambulance arrived, other fire department volunteers scooped her up into the clinic. You know, I mean, by that time they defibrillated her, got her heart started again, into the clinic, and eventually stabilized and off to Juneau, and lo and behold, all good.
Wow.
And she lived a few more years after that. But has since passed.
Right.
And so, yeah, she was quite the dynamic force on the Tilkoot for many years.
Yeah. Wow, that's a great story. Saved by her own EMS system.
Mm-hmm.
There's something else I was going to ask. So you retired in 2012.
At the end of 2012. So yeah, I worked the full year essentially. I had the great good luck, I consider it a good luck, good fortune, to have the opportunity to actually meet and train my replacement. I say train, it's really more orient.
Mm-hmm.
And Vicki McMillan had worked elsewhere in the regional office, and was selected to replace me. And I think there was an understanding at the time that almost no one else in the region knew anything about the leasing program. And so a decision was made to actually bring her down before my retirement, about a month or so, maybe a month and a half, and for us to be able to spend as much time as possible to brief her on mm-hmm. that, try and bring her up to speed. So that was actually kind of fun, because I had never seen that almost anywhere
right.
else. It's a luxury in
right.
some ways.
Why did you choose to leave? Had you done so many years of service and you were done? Is that
By that time I'd completed 35 years of creditable service. And I think it was credited for something more than that, because I had a year of unused sick leave. And so when you look at, okay, the annuity that would have yielded, you know, that was a reasonable time to retire. It, for me, was, you could call it an early retirement. I certainly couldn't have worked longer, but I was 57. Marlene was very definitely ready to
yeah,
finish.
Yeah, it sounds like she was ready to leave.
And it was her retirement date that defined when we left town.
Okay.
Because in order to achieve the minimum annuity under the state of Alaska system, she had to work 7 years. And that's what she would have in the end of the May of 2013. So we stayed another 5 months.
Right.
And by that point, I was getting a lot of pressure on the Park Service side. If you want a paid return move to the lower 48,
you better do it now.
Yeah, you got to do it now.
Right.
And so it wasn't really any choice to hang out any longer. And we've been back and forth pretty much every year
right,
for some period of time since then.
Because you said you still own property there.
We still own property there. We have friends there. that we need to go and see, we need to hang out with, and it is important for us to, you know, spend a little bit of time with the rental property. Sharon Bolton, who I met when I first started working at the Chamber of Commerce, she has a little accounting business there in Skagway. Bolton Cabin is there at 15th and State Street. It's quite a fixture. It always smells like cigarette smoke on the inside. But I mentioned her because she's managing our rental units there now, and that's made it possible. It's really actually worked out quite well for us, so I've been happy for that. This last spring, when we went up, when we arrived, I think it was Deb Betcher that said, "You need to meet Keely, the new AO who's arrived here. You should meet him. He's down working at this little grocery store." And I said, "What?" It's like, "But didn't you say he was working for the park?" "Yeah, no, but he's also moonlighting at this little grocery store." Okay, so I walked on in and introduced myself, said hi, howdy, said, "If you want to get together sometime and chat, I'd be happy to do that. If you have any questions, I know, you know, if you're new," he's new to the Park Service and new to to the leasing program especially. And he did eventually call me and say, "Yeah, if you want to spend some time, you know, we'll chat and walk the street and point at things," and which we did. I gave some help to another individual on his staff who was scratching her head over some of the leasing calculations. So I spent a few hours with her. Personal friend as well, yeah. Laura maybe, works on the staff. And had an opportunity to meet the new superintendent, whose name escapes me now, but and seems like a great chap. A question he had for me, and since we're kind of running out of other things, you asked about land acquisition, and yes, the park did acquire, during my tenure, a housing unit. We also set up a scheme to sublease, if you will, I don't know how else to put it, from Customs and Border Protection quarters on mm-hmm. Dairy Drive, at the north end of town, you know, off this Klondike Highway. They were surplus to customs needs at the time. They'd had like, I don't know, 8 or 10 units put in, and they had 3 of them vacant, and we took all 3, and we said, "Yeah, this would be great." I had to talk the superintendent, Tim Corliss, into doing this. He had great misgivings about it because he knew that customs could take them back at a heartbeat. You know, they need them, right. They change staffing. I felt that we were so desperate for housing that that would be a good thing, whatever we could get. And and then because I had regular dealings with individuals in the lands office in Anchorage, because of my past experience in other parks and land acquisition programs, I found out that they had money available. Another project in another park in Alaska had been canceled, and that land acquisition money was fluid. And we went shopping. And for a while, I was the most popular guy in town because everybody that wanted to sell a house beat a path to my door. And then Scott Logan and I would go out, usually it was the 2 of us, and we'd go through a place, and or we'd bring other staff with us if we thought it was worth looking at. You know, there were a lot of old shoes that weren't really worth a second look, and we could figure that out pretty fast. And then 2 homes that we decided were promising enough and worth enough that it made sense to spend the money to have appraisals done on mm-hmm. those 2. And ended up buying what now the park, I think they probably still refer to it as the Cedar House up at 20th and Alaska, no, 20th and Main Street. That is a 3-bedroom, 2-bath, you know, attached garage. And if I'm not mistaken, I think that's where the superintendent's living now.
It sounds like that might be a superintendent's style of house.
And the question he posed to me the superintendent this last spring was, gee, do you know anything about that? And I said, why, yes. You know, I ramrodded the purchase of that, and we got our hands slapped because apparently we didn't ask permission of the Washington office in the right way at the right time. But in any event, it worked. And he said, well, was that purchased as the superintendent's residence? And I said, absolutely not. It was purchased with the idea of turning three bedrooms into three seasonal units, quarters for at least three, if not four or five, probably not six, because one of the bedrooms was too tiny. But we were really, that was the idea. It was going to be seasonal housing. And he seemed a little disappointed to hear that. I think there's some hard feelings about how housing's been assigned out. But I thought it was a good thing that we were able to add to the housing stock. Yeah.
I just said, I know it's getting late, mm-hmm. and you're probably exhausted, but just some sort of summary overview, reflective questions, looking back at your time in Skagway, what you think were your biggest accomplishments, or that you're most proud of accomplishing?
I always felt that because there was really no one else on the staff who could have and ever really did manage the leasebacks, that was really my greatest legacy, if you will, to the park, was to say, okay, we built on what I found when I arrived there, and we tried to manage it to the best end effect for the park. It wasn't always, I mean, it didn't continue to grow, it didn't even stay the same size, it shrank, but it shrank in response to the park's needs and without steamrolling the tenants. So I always tried to be kind of their champion in the face of the park staff, sometimes forgetting that these are private business operators who really, it's a different ship. They run a different ship. And so my job was to be there to translate, if you will, to the two sides there. Right. So, you know, I don't think that you could, I would point to anything else. Perhaps what I felt was always a famously good relationship with Parks Canada and the staff from top to bottom at Parks Canada. They're great people, and I thought that we did a fine job of accommodating each other's needs and always maintaining our focus on public safety, mm-hmm. you know, and communication. So those two things are probably the standout in my mind. Improving a relationship with the townsfolk and the Dyea residents in particular, I think everybody had a hand in that. It wasn't, you know, and if everybody hadn't been working on it, it wouldn't have improved.
Right.
So I lent my hand to that, but that wasn't just me.
What about frustrations or challenges?
Primary frustrations were with the decision made at the regional office to use Skagway as a training park for new superintendents. And I think that ultimately, you know, I mean, Mike Trunnell would be an example of a tremendous success. You know, he wasn't there 1, 2, 3 years. He was there for several years and mm-hmm. made a huge positive impact. If that had happened repeatedly, that kind of thing, I'd be, I would view it very differently, but we had a number of years where we suffered on account of it, and we, meaning the whole staff, suffered. And the records of the region would bear me out.
Are there any things that you, I sort of say regrets, but things you wish you could have done that you were not able to do in your years there?
I I was ambitious enough to, I would have liked to have been the one in charge.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, that's the obvious one, the natural right. one. I felt that I had the prior experience, the breadth of knowledge. In the end, I'd probably have to say I didn't have the right temperament, and so it wasn't going to happen. Mm-hmm. And maybe ultimately that was for the best. We have no way of knowing right. that. But I would have loved to have had the opportunity.
Right. Well, you mentioned, so what was your temperament? Or, you have a particular managerial style at how you were operated?
I think there was a time when I had a much more volatile temper. And so between a temper and, I hate to say, a suffer fool's poorly.
Right.
I would get in people's faces, you're not doing your job. It's like, and for some people that was just did not work.
Yeah.
So I think if I'd been more adaptable, if I'd been more flexible, I'd had a better understanding of when to relax and rest in confidence in the role and not struggle with it, I think it would have worked a lot better. So in retrospect, I look back and I think, things went much more smoothly when I did just that, mm-hmm. relaxed on that, said, okay, I'll do the best with my job and not worry about upward climbing.
And what about relationships with your staff? How was that?
Some good, some not so good. And again, some of it to do with like-mindedness. You've already heard me
right.
talk about some where we were very copacetic. Evelyn Meyer, who was in administration from before my arrival to after my departure from the park, the entire tenure that I worked there, she was working in administration. As an administrative tech, I think, originally, eventually promoted as a budget technician. She was a jack of all trades in administration. She had the answer for almost anything that came up. She had some insight into how things had worked before, who to go to. And what I'd say is that Evelyn and I, thankfully, seemed to work together smoothly, and I relied on her tremendously. And while there needed to be two of her in order to actually do everything that she needed to do, and that was the suffering that I could see, was that her desk would just pile high. It was just, there were just too many lines plugged in.
Right.
And so I could see that, okay, this was, for all of us, was just, the complexity was increasing more and more. But I don't think that park would ever have run as well as it did, and certainly not for me in administration without her. Top of the list.
Mm-hmm. So, looking back on your Park Service career, how do you reflect back? Glad you worked for the Park Service? Wish you'd chosen a different path? Proud of your service? I don't know.
I made some enemies and powerful enemies very early on in my career by being a young hothead. Not recommended. Not a good thing. And when I say powerful enemies, when you see an agency like the National Park Service that is has jurisdictions across not only the 50 states, but territories as well, mm-hmm. geographically tremendously diverse. I don't know how many time zones. Okay, huge. Okay, it's a very small organization for covering so much ground. Mm-hmm. Really tight organization. So if you have someone that, you know, can change the course of your career, right, they can do an amazing amount of damage. So the advice as always is, mind your manners.
But are you proud of your career? The work you did?
I love the fact that I worked in so many different kinds of places, that I made substantial contributions to the operating and the planning for operations for those parks. But probably more than anything else, I like the fact that I have a lot of interesting stories. I just need to find new people to tell them.
Well, you had a captive audience here, that's for sure. I've enjoyed it very much. That's sort of a good place to wrap it up, I think, for tonight. You have anything else
you wanted
to say. I know you had taken some notes of your own.
I use these to just to make reference to remind me of certain names, mm-hmm. And some of the things I didn't want to lose track of altogether. But I think we've
got them
ticked
all?
Them off. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a long day.
What a delightful experience.
Good. Thank you.